This is Audible.
Blackstone presents Alien 3, the unproduced first draft screenplay, William Gibson, by Pat Cadigan. This book is read by Bradford Hastings.
Chapter 1. Homo sapiens had been gazing up at the stars for about 300 millennia, before they finally managed to launch themselves off the planet of their origin toward those countless points of light. It was nowhere near as long before interstellar space travel became as matter-of-fact as the daily commute on the freeway had been for previous generations. By that time, humanity had been through many changes, but certain things were perennial. Humanity's restless curiosity, competitive spirit, and stubborn territoriality, which had so often caused hostilities among themselves. Then humans made contact with other intelligent species and discovered, to their uncomfortable surprise, that as a civilization newly capable of space travel, they had an awful lot to learn, mostly about distance. The standard for planet dwellers was miles or kilometers. In space, however, the distances were so enormous they were measured in terms of light speed, ranging from the light year all the way down to the light second. Humanity found that the old organizational models that had, in one form or another, guided the development of civilization on Earth didn't hold up at such a large scale. One of the biggest adjustments for humankind was in the area of conflict resolution. For most planet-based societies, it was business as usual. War, then peace, then war, then peace, interspersed with diplomacy or political chicanery, depending. War in space, however, just wasn't possible. In the time it took for opposing forces to meet for combat, circumstances on their respective sides had changed and they had no reason to fight. This was due in part to the fact that although space travel had become easier, it still wasn't cheap. In general, no government could afford, much less condone, the expense of sending out a fleet of warships just to have them destroyed. Nor did it make sense to fight over territory when there was more than enough to go around. Even in the remote arm of the Milky Way where Earth was located, there was a plethora of unclaimed worlds where humans could plant a flag. Many of the planets needed terraforming, but there was no shortage of technology or volunteers for new colonies, either in search of adventure or simply because they wanted a fresh start on a new world. The colonists on LV-426 were all first waivers, i.e. terraformers, who were in the process of turning a rock into a not-so-hard place. LV-426 was actually a planetoid in stable orbit around an equally stable star, but its wealth of natural resources was the real appeal for its co-financiers. Both the American Extrasolar Colonization Administration and the Weyland-Yutani Corporation agreed that it would be worth every penny of their respective investments. Weyland-Yutani had been so confident they had requested the colony be named Hadley's Hope in honor of their first administrator, Curtis Hadley. Besides terraformers and environmentalists, the 150 residents of Hadley's Hope also included research scientists, engineers, geologists, and warm bodies for manual labor, along with their families and a full complement of medics, nutritionists, educators, and other support personnel. Working continuously around the clock, they produced a breathable atmosphere in under 40 years, breaking the previous record of 59 years. Hadley's Hope became the prime example of how a partnership between a governmental body and a corporation in the private sector could yield a success that both could be proud of, a brilliant jewel in their two-headed crown. Or it had been, until that awful woman suddenly popped up out of nowhere after being in cold sleep for 47 years, claiming there were monsters on LV-426. Some grotesque creature had supposedly killed all her crewmates on a freighter called the Nostromo, where she'd been a warrant officer. With the rest of the crew dead, she'd been forced to abandon ship and blow it up, saving only the ship's cat. The crew had been killed, but she saved the cat? Yeah, that could happen to anyone. The crazy cat lady had to be trouble. Right after she showed up, Weyland-Yutani lost all contact with the colonists, as if she'd jinxed them. A rescue party of Marines was sent out, taking the crazy cat lady with them, and that was the end of the matter. There was no further mention in the general news outlets, and the details faded from public awareness. Had anyone given it even a brief thought, it was with the assumption that the Colonial Marines had taken care of everything. They always did. 4 years later, the Union of Progressive People's Border Protection Crew received an alert that a spacecraft was heading straight for them. If it continued on its course, it would enter the UPP sector in blatant violation of a treaty the unprincipled capitalists had sworn they would honor unfailingly above all things. Breaking promises was typical of capitalists. The UPP Governing Council were only surprised that it had taken them so long. The Sulaco had departed for LV-426 with a squad of 12 Colonial Marines and the synthetic assigned to them, plus two civilians, a Weyland-Yutani bureaucrat and the crazy cat lady. When it reappeared 4 years later, there were only four passengers aboard, all in sleep capsules. One Marine, the now-forgotten crazy cat lady, a 9-year-old girl who was the sole survivor of the Hadley's Hope colony, and the Marine synthetic, or rather, what was left of him. A human couldn't have survived such catastrophic injuries. Most synthetics wouldn't have made it either, but this was a particularly robust model, built for adverse conditions, skilled in the use of many different kinds of equipment, including weapons. Unfortunately, none of these things had protected him from an enraged Queen Xenomorph. But then, all the Marine skills, training, and weapons hadn't done them much good either. And to make matters worse, it wasn't over.